Welcome back to the Feature Photographer of the Month, and with us today is, he's one of my heroes. He's right up there with John Glenn, I got to say, isn't it? that's right. Hey, you are. You know, I grew up in the space age. And anyway, it's a Baryonyx Perrello, and if you don't know who this guy is, you've been living under a rock for a while, but he is the producer and host of The Candid Frame, which, in my opinion, is the best photography podcast out there, and if you don't listen to it, go to your podcatcher and subscribe. Does that, he's an educator, he's a writer, he's been in the photography field for over 25 years, worked in the magazine field, used to work for Nikon, and so welcome, Baryonyx. It's really good to have you on. It's great to finally meet you.
Bob, thank you so much for having me. It's a real honor to have a chance to speak with you and to appear in the magazine, so thanks.
Yeah, no, glad to do it, glad to do it. Well, I always like to start out to learn more about you. You know, I mean, I feel like I already know you listening to so many of your shows, but hopefully we can learn a little bit more. Why don't you just give us a little bit of your background. Tell us what you've been up to and how you got to where you are today.
Oh, the short version of all that is that I was, I've been lucky in that all my professional career has always revolved around photography, because I started, taking pictures when I was like 10 years old, and I always was just fascinated with the idea of a camera. And when I went to Los Angeles City College, it was the first time I got a chance to apply my interest both in writing and in photography by joining the newspaper. And then I sort of got this journalism bug underneath me. And I went to Berkeley and I got a degree in English Lit. And I had intended to go to the University of Missouri to get a degree in journalism. But I said, oh, I'll take a break for a year, which was a big mistake because I never went back. And came back to Los Angeles where I was raised, and I ended up getting a job at Nikon. And I was there for about 8 years, but I remember when I first got there, I would see these other guys who had been there for 7 or 8 years, and I was like, how the hell do you stay at one job for 8 years? And then 8 years later, I found out, it just creeps on you, day after day. But by the end of my run there, I was really itching to get back into writing and getting my stuff into print. And there was an ad for a position at Outdoor Photographer magazine, and I applied, didn't get it, but then about 6 months later, the position opened up again, and I applied, went in for an interview, and I got it. And I left Nikon, and I started working as an associate editor for Outdoor Photographer, Digital Photo Pro magazine eventually, and PC Photo, which eventually turned into Digital Photography magazine. And there I worked as an editor, not only writing articles and illustrating them with my own photographs, doing reviews of equipment, but also editing other photographers and writers that contributed to the magazine, like Rick Salmon, who some listeners may know. I was a regular contributor to the magazine, and I was his editor anytime he submitted an article. And after about 8 years there, I just went freelance, and I started writing not only for those magazines, but practically all the photo magazines like Rangefinder, Shutterbug, Popular Photography. Anyone who would take a pitch from me, I would write an article for. And a little soon after, I started writing books. I think I've written going over 5 books. I think I'm on my 6th right now. There's a new book that's going to be coming out in November or December. But it was like magazine writing, book writing, and then teaching. I was an adjunct professor at the Art Center College of Design here in the Pasadena area. And I also teach my own workshops, and I teach some classes through the Los Angeles Center of Photography down here in Los Angeles in Hollywood. And so I'm just one of those photographers who, does a little bit of everything in order to eke out a living. And that's my story.
Yeah, I think that's what you have to do nowadays is do a number of different things.
Yeah.
Piece them together.
And as you mentioned, of course, I kind of omitted it, is the Candid Frame was as a podcast, which I've been doing for about 12 years, which started when I was out in working at the magazine, which was on the west side of town. So for people who don't know Los Angeles, I live in the Pasadena area, and the magazine was in the Westwood area near Santa Monica, which is about 30 miles. And so what I was contending with was a commute that was like an hour to get to work and an hour and a half to get back. And a way that I would sort of pass the time would be at first listening to music, but that got old. And then I would listen to books on tape. And then I sort of got kind of bored with that. And then I heard about this thing called podcasting. It wasn't even on iTunes, you know, it was nothing like that. It was just this Friends thing I'd heard about where all these people would create these shows to talk about anything and everything. So I figured out how to download those things to my iPod, and I would listen to those. And I gravitated to the photography-related shows, but I soon realized that most of the shows revolved around talking about equipment and gear, and there was no one talking about photography. And so I said, well, somebody should do that. And then I thought about it and said, well, I know all these photographers from working in the magazine and working at Nikon. I know how to interview people, so why don't I just do it? And so I just learned how to record a podcast, how to edit it on GarageBand, how to create a blog, so on and so forth. And, you know, at first I just started coming out with these interviews every other week, and then eventually I went every week. And 12 years later, I'm still doing it.
Yeah, you're like a machine. I mean, every week there's another interview with somebody really good. It's hard to keep up with. How do you do that? I mean, how do you stay so consistent like that? You must be one of the most organized people I've ever met.
Oh, I wish. No, with the show now at this point, it's fairly easy to do. I mean, as long as I can get the schedules between me and the people that I want to have on the show in sync, I'm okay. I usually try and get three interviews in a week so that I'm not under pressure to produce it, you know, to find someone every week. I like to have like three in the can, ideally. So, you know, and sometimes I just can't. Like right now I'm writing the book, so I fall a little behind in terms of having a bunch of interviews in the can. But usually I try and do that. So it can, the most time-consuming part of it now is just doing the research for everyone before I sit down and talk with them, because I try to read or listen or watch as much content on the photographer that I'm going to have on the show, so I can, you know, sound halfway intelligent while I'm talking to them. And I think that's the most labor-intensive part of it, because the conversations usually just run an hour. And luckily, I have a friend of mine in San Francisco, Martin Taylor, who's been editing the show for about, I think, at least half the duration that the show's been around. And that saves me a lot of time, not having to sit down and, you know, having to cut and edit it the way that I used to when I first released the show.
It does. It's time-consuming to do that. And so it's nice to have somebody to handle the editing for you. What do you do? You record it and drop it into a Dropbox, and he picks it up.
Yeah,
and then
exactly.
Yep.
Yeah, I record it. You know, I do a left channel for my voice, a right channel for their voice. Hmm. He splits it when he gets the audio file, and then he tweaks it, you know, to make both of us sound as, you know, as clear as possible. Takes out some of the more embarrassing parts, and you know, and then ties it all together. And then Sunday nights, I'm updating the blog and getting all the all the hyperlinks together so that people can click on the show notes and go to the photographer's website and all that other stuff. And that usually on Sunday nights usually only takes me about an hour and a half to get it done. You know, but sometimes there are always unexpected things that come up. I had one interview that I thought was fine, and I was ready to release it, and there was a bunch of distortion on the guest end that I did not hear. Ooh. And I was recording, and then Martin sent me that note that Sunday night, and I was just like, well, let me listen to it. And it was terrible. There's no way you could release it. And thank goodness I had another episode in the can that I could send him. You know, Otherwise, I wouldn't have had a show that week. So that's another reason why I try to have more in reserves, because you never know when something catastrophic like that happens. And you know, if you don't have something in reserve, then there's just no show.
Yeah. Have you ever had to do any do-overs?
Oh, yeah. Currently, I have to do two do-overs, because that one that I just mentioned, I have to do over. And there was another one that had similar audio problems, because I guess the person's internet connection was just spotty. But, yeah, there have been times when, you know, the audio either got distorted or there was just something wrong, and I had to do it over. And I think there's one time I actually... The file just was not there. I looked for the file and it just wasn't there. And I don't know what happened to it. And so I had to suck it up and call the person and say, hey, can you mind doing it again? But I've never had anyone who's declined to do it. Everyone seems to have joined the conversations enough that it's not problematic for us to do it again. But, you know, if I can avoid doing that at all, if at all possible, I much prefer just to do it once and just do it right.
Yeah, and then it's more fresh. I've only had one. Of course, I haven't done nearly as many as you, but it was really funny because everything sounded fine and went to edit it, and my voice sounded like Alvin the Chipmunk.
Oh,
really? Wow. Mine was all sped up, and the other channel with the other two people was normal. And I tried to stretch it out and do all these tricks. Finally, I said, forget this. I contacted them, and they said, sure, we'll do it again. And it came out better anyway. But you never know. But
yeah.
Anyhow, you interview photographers, but you interview some pretty amazing photographers, you know, people like Joel Meyerowitz, Jay Mazel, Sam Abel, one of my very favorite shows you did. How do you get these people? Is it because of your experience in the publishing business, or you're just, they can't say no to you?
You know, it surprises me, and maybe it shouldn't surprise me, but there are a lot of people who just are unfamiliar with podcasting even to this day, and a lot of people have never heard of the show. But I think I usually in my initial email I reference other people who I've interviewed on the show, like some of the names that you've mentioned. And I think that helps a little bit in terms of them saying yes, because they see who else I've talked to, you know. And I don't know if many of those people have ever listened to an episode of the show by the time that I've interviewed them. You know, they just see it as an opportunity to promote something that they're doing or their work or a book or whatever it is. So it's just another outlet for them for them to practice, you know, some self-promotion. Some people take a little more work to do just because they're so busy, and they may get a lot of demands for their time, or maybe this kind of promotion is not high on their priority list. So sometimes, you know, it's taken me quite a while to land some people for the show, while others have been, you know, as soon as I email them, they get right back to me and say, hey, you know, I'll be more than happy to do it. So, you know, there's some people I've written letters to and never heard back, but I just keep trying, and, you know, hopefully at some point I'll get to land them on the show. So we'll see.
Yeah, don't wait for the phone to ring. They always
no,
say.
No, you don't.
Yeah, you seem to have really mastered the new media. I mean, you do a lot of different things besides the podcast. You have you've got a great YouTube channel. It's a great resource for anybody who's a photographer. And so you're active on YouTube. You're at Twitter. I think you tweet more than Donald Trump. We're close to it.
I do stuff that's more substantive. I'll say that. At least that's my hope.
Yeah. Hey, you retweeted a post of ours the other day. I appreciate that.
Oh, did you?
Yeah.
Oh, good.
Thank you. That was nice of you. And, you know, you're very active on Instagram. And where else are you? Oh, Flickr. You've got a great Flickr group. How did you come up with that mix? Are you always just trying new things?
Yeah, that's what it just comes down to. It's just trying new things, you know, because it's just with the show, ultimately, I'm trying to get people to, you know, to discover it in one way or another. And I find that just doing all those things sort of helps people discover podcasts, because a lot of people, even in this day and age, you know what podcasts are, but they have never really sort of looked into it. And I'm hoping that I can promote either a photographer or a conversation that might pique their interest, and they'll tune it in, and then they'll listen, and they'll like what they hear, and then as a result, they'll subscribe and help spread the word. I mean, because largely, you know, it's been word of mouth that has helped the show grow over the last 12 years. I've never paid for advertising or any sort of marketing plan. It's just like I put the show out there, and I've used social media to help spread the word. And it's, you know, it's grown as much as it has. But, you know, there's such a huge interest in audience for photography. And I'm just trying to find my niche. Because the great majority, I mean, there are shows that are much bigger than mine, but the reason they're so big is because they focus exclusively on equipment mm-hmm. or equipment reviews. Like you see some, you know, YouTube channels that have hundreds of thousands of views for a camera.
Yeah.
Right? But if it's focused on a photographer, there's a lot less interest. And for me, I don't want to change my format and focus more on equipment because I'm really not interested in that. I mean, I like gear, but I don't want to dedicate conversations to it. So I'm just trying to find people who are sort of like-minded, who really love photography, but they love talking, hearing about the craft, about the process, about the journey to becoming a professional photographer, or even a non-professional photographer who finds a way of practicing photography and making it part of their lives. I mean, I enjoy those conversations. So that's what I dedicate myself to. And I know that there are tens of thousands of people that are out there who would really enjoy what I do, but they just haven't found their way to me yet. So ultimately, why I have my hand in so many things is in the hope that people find us.
I don't know if you can talk about this, but about how many downloads do you get per episode?
Episode, it varies. I think total monthly downloads is about 50,000.
Hmm.
But that is over the entire archive of interviews. So, because people discover us and they start going through the backlog. So it's evergreen content, unlike some other shows that are more like news shows. So you're not going to listen to a news show from a year ago. So I have people who found the show and they will go back all the way to episode one and listen to all, at this point, 425 episodes, which to me is just like, I couldn't even imagine listening to all those episodes again.
Yeah,
but people do. And I just take it as a compliment that people find value in even some of those earlier episodes, which I sometimes cringe at. That, not so much because of the content, but just because of the unevenness of the audio quality. Because I was trying to figure things out, and some of the episodes are less than ideal. Now they're fairly consistent, but back then, man, it was a wild west.
Hey, just binging on it on the show. Really, any podcast is a great way to spend a long drive.
Oh yeah, yeah. I get lots of messages from people who, as part of their normal day-to-day commute or they're traveling across the country, listen to our shows. So that's really gratifying that I'm able to keep people company.
Let me ask you this, because I mean, you are pretty much of an expert, social media expert, new media expert. You know, being a publisher, many people come to us because they want to be known. I mean, I think anybody mm-hmm. who's a photographer wants to be recognized and wants to be known. And they ask me a lot, how do I get known? And you've talked to probably many of the most famous photographers in the world, and people not so famous, but they're still pretty well known. Is there any formula or any secret that you know of that people could apply to get the word out more about their own work?
You know, it really starts with producing really good work. I mean, that really is what sparks my interest in anybody that I want to have on the show, because I have people that don't have a reputation, that they have not had dozens of articles written about them, but I'll find something about them maybe in a blog post or I'll maybe find them on Instagram, or maybe I'll see something on a YouTube channel. And they're just working on a project, or they just produce a body of work that really kind of fascinates me, and I just want to learn more about it. So it always starts there. You know, I find that people working on personal projects is something I have a particular affinity for. So if I hear someone's working on a personal project of some sort, then that for me is a big in. And I think for anyone, especially who's interested in working as a professional photographer, particularly in sort of the editorial or the fashion world, or, you know, or even in the world of nature and landscape, if you're working on a personal project that has an idea or a theme, that goes a long way in getting people interested in what you're doing. If you're just sort of just a photographer who just makes some nice pictures, but there's no real idea or concept behind them, it makes it really hard for you to be able to say, this is who I am and this is what I do. People really need something to sort of sink their teeth into and to get excited about looking at what you're doing. If that's not part of your repertoire, then it's time to sort of rethink it and find something to focus on. I just interviewed Dothan Sagai, who's been working on a documentary project on Venice Beach. And I forget exactly how I discovered Dothan. I think another person I interviewed recommended him. But when I saw these pictures from Venice Beach, I absolutely had to have him on the show. And I had him on the show back in January, and we talked about the project. And this past week, we talked about the release of his book and everything that he went through in order to get a book published. Because he went through a traditional publisher rather than strictly self-publishing, but he still had to jump through all these hoops in order to make it happen. So for me, the project and everything that he went through in order to create it and get it published, that's an interesting story.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that in terms of my podcast, or, you know, as a person who is going to write a magazine article on someone, I want to have an interesting story to go along with what are great pictures. But if you don't have a story that you can tell about yourself or your work, you know, you don't make it easy for people like us to be able to turn that into something. So it has to start with a photographer having a clear idea of why they create the things they create, especially if it's a personal project.
So when someone does a personal project or a photo story, how important is it to have compelling text to go along with it?
Oh, that all depends. That all depends. I mean, you know, there's some people who don't do text, but they just put together a really substantive, impactful body of work with a very short description of what it's about, and the image sort of carries itself. But, you know, if they've created an amazing body of work and they want to get it seen, you know, one of the things that people do is that they'll send in that body of work to maybe one of these blogs that's dedicated to photography, mm-hmm. or basically whatever subject matter that the project is covering, and they'll have to basically write a query letter saying, hey, this is a work that I've been working on. It addresses this idea, these themes, these issues. I think it would be a great fit for your publication, whether it's in print or online. And I welcome the opportunity for you to consider it for publication. I mean, it's really basic. You have to have that basic skill set of being able to reach out. But, you know, again, it starts with having a good idea, knowing where it would be a good fit, because you don't want to send, this great documentary project that you've done on your hometown to Playboy, you know? It's just like it just doesn't fit. But you'd be surprised at how some people really don't consider where they're sending their work to. Because I experienced that a lot when I was at the magazines. People would send in work or want to be published in the magazine, and it was like they never read the magazine.
Yes,
because it wasn't a fit. It's like, if you took the time to read the magazine, you'd know. And I get that on the show as well. I get solicitations for people who want to be on the show, you know, and they start off great podcast, blah, blah, blah. But then I read, you know, what they want to come on the show and talk about. And I go, you've never listened to the show, because if you listen to at least one episode, you'd know that this isn't appropriate for for the candid frame. But, you know, that's just the nature of things.
I know. We still receive lots of wedding photos. Maybe photos of a photographer taking photos of somebody on the street in a wedding, but just the wedding photos. No, this isn't a wedding photo magazine. Sorry.
Yeah.
So you probably don't have to do the candid frame. I'm sure you have lots of other facets to your work. And I mean, how has it helped your career, and how has it helped your own personal photography?
Well, it's open doors for me. I've never made any money, real money from the show. I mean, people have donated to the show, and I have some Patreon supporters, and that helps, you know, address the sort of the costs of maintaining a show, especially over this long period of time. But, you know, it's allowed my name to get out there in ways that it didn't when I was working and writing for magazines, because I was just, you know, another byline in a lot of magazine articles that would disappear 30 days later. So I kind of earned a reputation for being this really good interviewer of photographers. And, you know, when I first submitted my first book proposal, the people who I submitted it to were aware of who I was as a result of the podcast. So that helped. And, you know, a lot of other opportunities. I got invited to go to South Africa last year to teach at a workshop. And they were just listeners to the show, and they sent me an email and said, "Hey, do you want to come out to Johannesburg? And I was like,
"Why not?
Yeah, sure." You know, so it's been some wonderful experiences. I've met some great people, and I've had a chance to sort of network in a way that I don't think would have happened had I not been doing the podcast.
That's true. A friend of mine has a podcast, and he's a podcast coach. That's the School of Podcasting, and he has a segment on a show every now and then. It's called Because of My Podcast, and so he has these podcasters come on, and they talk about things that have happened to them in their lives as a result of doing their show. Most of them have nothing to do with money, and it's all about experiences and doors opening. It's pretty amazing, I've got to say.
Yeah, and the best thing for me is that I've had the chance to sit with people who have been my photographic heroes. You know, just a couple of months ago, William Albert Allard, Bill Allard, came to town. He was teaching a workshop at the Leica Gallery, and I interviewed him for the second time on the show. But while he was in town, I got to go and hang out with him and have lunch with him. And he took a photograph of me, and we had coffee. And I was just like, oh, my God, I'm sitting with Bill Allard, you know. And we're talking to each other as peers. And this is a guy whose work I discovered when I was in college. And I remember just looking through his books and looking through his photo stories in National Geographic, and just, you know, just taking those images apart, trying to understand how he used Kodachrome and how he used light. And here I was, you know, 25 plus years later, and I'm sitting with him, talking and hanging out with him. And I was just like, oh my, I was just so giddy. And the show has provided me opportunities like that. I mean, I've talked with Mary Helen Mark. I was, again, sitting with her in person, interviewing her, Joe Meyerowitz, Dan Winters. I mean, just, you know, people who I would never imagine having a chance to really just sit down in depth and talking with them, and in some cases, you know, becoming friends with. That for me has made the show absolutely invaluable in terms of the experiences that it's given me.
I'm glad you brought up the show that you just did with Bill Allard. I listened to that a few weeks ago when it came out, and it wasn't just an interview you did with him. I mean, it was like we got to listen into a nice conversation you had with the guy, and he talked about some very personal things that happened in his life and his career that, you know, I was never aware of. And I'm always curious, how can you bring those things out?
You know, I get, to my thinking, it's really simple. is that I listen. Is that I don't go in with the standard lazy questions in terms of how did you get into photography? What kind of camera do you use? What's your favorite picture? For me, that's just lazy interviewing. Mm-hmm. And if you start off that way, most people just sort of either turn off or they just get into their standard spiel, mm-hmm. right? They're not going to make any effort to really give you anything that's genuine as part of the conversation because they don't feel like you've made the effort. So for me, I always try and take as much care as I can with my first question to sort of establish the tone, to let them know that this is not just going to be, you know, BS interview where I'm just throwing questions at them, not listening to what they're saying, and then just moving on to the next question. I really want to have a conversation. And it really helps that, you know, as part of my questioning, that they know I know their work, mm-hmm. you know, and that I bring I bring a perspective to the conversation about their work that I think they appreciate it because they sometimes they appreciate the thoughtfulness that I've taken in considering their work. And as a result of that, the conversation becomes real. And so I'm able to take the conversations to places that they might not otherwise. And that for me is always really a good sign when I get people really surprised at where the conversation has gone. You know, I can hear it in their voice. You know, and then I feel like, okay. And it's especially a challenge because the great majority of the conversations are happening over Skype. So we're not in the same room together. It's a lot easier when you're in the same room and you have eye contact and you can do that. But, you know, it's a little more difficult to do it over Skype. But I think I've gotten to be pretty good at being able to do that. And it has so much to do, not just with the questions, but the enthusiasm in my voice when I talk to them. They can hear it. Mm-hmm. And I think that really helps sort of break the ice and make it a conversation that people are really interested in listening to.
Yeah, I agree. Before I started this business, this magazine, and I knew I was going to do interviews, I basically went to school on you. And I think, what makes this interview so interesting? And I'd listen to questions over and over again, and I still have those notes from 5 years ago. Mm. And I should go back and try that again to see if it still applies. I'm sure you've evolved since then. And I'm going to embarrass you here because I've said this to several people that I think you're one of the best interviewers in American media today. I put you up with like Terry Gross and Chris Cuomo on CNN. I don't mean to embarrass you, but I really feel that way.
No, I mean it means a lot to me. I mean I work hard at it, and it's nice to, you know, have people acknowledge me in that way. It does. It touches me, and it just lets me know I got a high bar to meet. You know, I try not to get too lax when it comes to the interviews because I know people have an expectation now in terms of what the conversations are going to be like. And so even though I don't have any control of what the person I'm interviewing's style is going to be at being interviewed, I can nevertheless sort of bring everything that I can to the conversation and just hope that it works out. And sometimes I'm surprised because sometimes I just feel like I'm not vibing with the person I'm interviewing. And then I'll get emails from people saying, oh, it was a great conversation. You know, they really enjoyed it. And it's like, okay, that tells you how much I know.
Yeah, I'll take that. I'll take that. So do you have a favorite interview or anything really stand out? Or am I putting you on the spot here?
Yeah, not at this point. Okay. I mean, there's so many different interviews that I've just enjoyed. That I would really have to listen to them, you know, because now I've had so many interviews, I've I've forgotten some of the people that I've interviewed.
Yeah, I bet.
You know, people will remind me and go, oh, yeah, I guess I did interview them. Because it doesn't exactly ring a bell for me. But, you know, other than, you know, the people who are like my heroes, like, you know, Joe Meyerowitz, Jay Mazel, Mary Ellen Mark, Pete Turner, people who I just sort of grew up with as photographers who were influences on me, those have always been things I've always been happy with. But in terms of just conversations, yeah, you know, probably all the conversations I've had with Joel have been great. I think the Joel Meyerowitz interviews have been, some of my favorites, just because Joel is just so, he knows how to speak about photography, you know, and he's just, I don't have to do much, right? I just kind of set it up and he hits it out of the park, sort of thing. And with other people, you sort of have to work a little harder to elicit, you know, those moments of insight. And with Joel, you really don't have to do that. But, you know, I know that they've been conversations with people who I, you know, whose names don't pop into my head, but conversations that I've finished it and going, that was great. And, but you know, when you do as many as I have, I couldn't really pinpoint a particular episode that I'd say, okay, this is the best.
So would you compare your interviewing skills with being with the skills to be a good portrait photographer?
Oh, that's a good question.
Or I should rephrase that. How would you compare those skills?
For me, what's been essential for me in terms of my interviewing is not, I guess the two things that are in common is being completely in the moment. And that's necessary, I think, for both. Mm-hmm. In terms of being an interviewer, I don't work from a list of questions. I do all my research. I may put couple of words down on a piece of paper that I can refer to. But once I've established my first question, I just kind of roll with it and I'm listening to what they're saying. And then that sort of leads me to the next question, which leads to the next question that leads to the next question. I find that if I have a bunch of questions written down on a piece of paper, I get distracted by the questions. You know, they're saying something and then I'm looking at this piece of paper for the next question and I might miss something. So I don't do that. I just have those words there, especially if I find a moment where I'm kind of stuck. I'll just look down and I'll see a word, and then that will just lead me to it. And it doesn't distract me. When it comes to my photography, whether it's on the street or whether it's doing portraits, it's pretty much the same thing, being completely present and not being preoccupied by some sort of distraction. That's especially important for me with my street photography, because I don't want to be concerned about the stuff that happened the day before, even the hour before, or what I got to do after I finish shooting. For me, it's just like getting into that zone where I'm completely in the moment, that I'm completely present. And I think that is probably the one thing that is the consistent thing, the same thing, the similar thing that pervades all aspects of anything that I'm doing being creative. It's clearing out the noise and the voice in my head to the point that I can have this sort of laser focus on doing what's right in front of me.
I think that's a problem we all have in the modern world, is staying in the moment and staying focused because we have so many distractions. You know, whether it's social media or your phone or whatever. And but I'm glad you brought up street photography, since this is a show about street photography, and you are a very accomplished street photographer. And I know people want to listen to kind of get some tidbits from you. And I was wondering, what do you see as the, you know, the biggest hang-up that street photographers have, the biggest obstacle they have getting in their way of doing better work?
Oh, I think it's hesitancy about photographing people that they don't know, fear about people getting angry at them or people feeling like you're being disrespectful. And as a result, they don't create as good a photograph as they might be capable of doing. Sort of the stereotype is somebody with a 70 to 200 millimeter lens photographing somebody from across the street,
mm-hmm.
sort of playing it safe. Or a lot of it now is people using maybe a 35 or a 50 millimeter lens, but still being too far and not really looking. They just see somebody walking down the street. They take a photograph, and because it was on the street and it's a person, it qualifies as a street photograph. It's a boring street photograph. Yeah, it was standing on the street, includes people, but there's no vision there. And so I think that part of it is getting past your own resistance to making the kind of pictures you want to make on the street. And I've been doing it for years, and I still face those feelings. And I'm always having to fight against them in order to make the kind of photographs and make the kinds of compositions that I want. But, you know, at some point, the need and the desire to make the photograph has to surmount whatever emotional obstacles stand in the way. And sometimes I'm able to do that better than others. But that, I think, is the underlying challenge for anyone who wants to do this. And that's why so many people try it and then they stop doing it, because they can't get over that.
Yeah, they keep coming back with the same photograph over and over. Like me.
Yeah.
speaking of street photographers, do you mind if I talk about a few of your photos?
Sure, yeah.
Okay, because I'm looking at your website, and you have... I love the website, by the way.
Oh, thanks.
You know, so I'm in the business of building websites, and I see a lot of photographers use their website like a Flickr feed, or they just dump everything in there. And I like to see ones like yours where you're very selective about what you put in. And so I'm looking at the portfolio, the street color.
Okay.
Or color street. And there's one photo in there. I don't know if you have titles for your photo. I call it auto repair because it's got a big sign that says auto repair.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Right.
And I really, I won't go into why I like it, but I like it a lot. And it was something, it's something, if I would have been walking down that street, I wouldn't have seen this.
Mm.
But you saw this, and it's a very interesting photo. I love all the rectangles and the pattern that it makes, the way they all fit together. And how do you see something like that, that most of us would walk right past?
You know, it's really interesting. That was shot in South LA, which is not too far from where I grew up, which is about, for people who are kind of familiar with LA, it's south of USC. It's about 15 miles, 20 miles south of downtown Los Angeles. And one of the things I've noticed whenever I go visit my mom down there and I'm driving down this area is it's awash in color. There's a lot of immigrants from Mexico and Central America who live there, who work there. And the colors that they grew up with down in that part of the world has translated to this area of Southern California. Because if you go to other parts of Southern California, it's really almost monochrome. I mean, it's very muted colors. There really aren't colors that really pop. There's more of an attention to maybe architecture to some degree. But, you know, you can go through LA and it's just a bunch of strip malls and just there's mm-hmm. nothing particularly interesting. But whenever I drive down Figueroa or Slauson Boulevard, I see these colors and I see these shapes and I see these lines, and it just completely stands out to me. One, because it's so different to other parts of Los Angeles, but also because it's something that I grew up with. So I have been, and I haven't gotten to this, but I'm really inclined to go and like drive down there to visit my mom, but take my bike and just ride up and down those streets with my camera and just photograph all the stuff that's down there. Because I think it's one of One, it's because it's an area that is under-photographed, because most people don't go out there to photograph at all. It's not like downtown Los Angeles or Venice. You're not going to see any photographers out here. There are very few. There's only, I think, a handful of photographers that I know that have photographed regularly in that area whose work I've seen. So part of the appeal is just how specific it is to the community that basically calls that area of Los Angeles home. So when I see the colors and I see the shape of the security gate and the door and the signage and all that other stuff, you know, that's really familiar. And I just wanted to sort of document that. And then when I was when I photographed that, I was actually driving down the street. And I actually just stopped the car and I just made it out of my car. Because it was just like that seed in me. I got to come back and do this. So I don't know when I'm going to get around to doing it. But every time I go down to visit my mom, I see this stuff and I go, God damn it. I got to get off my ass and get it before somebody else does or before it changes. Because you know, sure. Parts of that area are getting gentrified as well. So some of this stuff may, you know, disappear in short order.
Oh, gentrification. Uh-oh. There goes the neighborhood.
Yeah.
Let me ask you about another one. You've probably told this story many times. I know because I read it. And it's the photo that's on the cover, Chasing the Light. I bought two copies of that book. I bought one for my son, who's a photographer.
Sure, thank you.
And then I bought one for myself that I have on my iPod. He's got the hard copy. And it's the dress, the picture of the dress on the cover. Mm-hmm. And you tell a real nice story about it. And I think everybody can learn something from this, but what can you tell us about that photo and your experience
in making it? Yeah, that photo was made in downtown Los Angeles, and I was with a group of other photographers. I don't think I was teaching a workshop. I think I was just hanging out with some other shooters. And I was walking down the street, and out of the corner of my eye, I see this mannequin in this dress in front of a closed storefront in I see the light hitting the dress, and I just immediately recognized the potential. And I ran over there and positioned myself, and I just started making a photograph of this dress against this, you know, this backdrop. And while I'm making the photograph, I'm just recognizing how beautiful it is. And other people are sort of walking around it because it's right smack dab in the middle of the sidewalk. So to everyone else, it's just an obstruction. You know, some idiot put a mannequin there that wasn't associated with any storefront that was there, because there was no storefront selling dresses. For some reason, someone stopped, put it there, and walked away, you know, probably intending at some point to get it back. But I looked at it, and I was just like, oh, my God, this is fantastic. And I made the photograph, and I always loved the photograph just because I recognized it. I recognized the scene. I recognized the potential for it, because I was, I think, with two or three other photographers, and they didn't see it. You know, they were ready to cross the street, but I saw it, and I just like, man, this is mine. You know, I got to make this. And when it came time for me to write that first book, I couldn't think of a better image to illustrate it.
Yeah, that was a good story, and it seems like one thing that we street photographers do a lot. They're just keep moving, look for the next thing. Mm-hmm. What's around the corner? And you probably miss a lot of things in the process of doing that. And how do you slow down and keep that from happening?
I've had to force myself to learn how to do that. I mean, I basically, I'll stand somewhere 20, 30 minutes, sometimes longer, just waiting for the scene to play out. I used to just walk and walk and walk, always on the hunt for something. And I do a lot less walking than I used to. If I find a scene that has the potential for a good photograph, I'll wait it out. Now, and that's so much of my photography today. I went on a photo walk while I was in San Francisco recently as part of Street Photo SF. And everyone just was walking through Powell Street, through Chinatown. And I just, about halfway through, I was like, I had enough. I was like, I can't keep doing this. You know, it's just like no one was stopping to really linger. You know, they would just keep walking, making photographs, and keep walking and keep walking. And it's like, there's no seeing in that. You know, you're just like grabbing and snapping stuff as you're walking. And for me, it's like finding a scene where there's great light and shadow and line and shape and color, and where I can basically shape the composition and then wait for the flourish of a gesture or someone walking through the scene or something, you know, to help complete the shot. So I talk a lot about making a photograph rather than taking it. And for me, that's my process for street photography. It's about combining and shaping all these different elements that normally don't have any relationship to each other, but within the composition, you know, within the context of the composition, make sense. You know, they create synergy and they're playing off of each other. For me, that's the fun of street photography, not just having these cat-like reflexes where I see something and I grab it and shoot and then keep walking. I mean, I get very little in that way. My better shots happen as a result of me just carefully observing what's happening in front of me and engaging its potential for a remarkable photograph, and then hoping that I have enough skill and awareness and patience to make it pan out.
Yeah, I think you hit the nail on the head there with one word, and you said process. Does it pay off to have a repeatable process that you can use over and over again? Not that you're making the same photograph every time, but you're disciplined to follow this system. I mean, I make it sound so clinical, but it's really not. But instead of just guessing the whole time.
Yeah, well, that's what this whole book that I'm writing that's going to come out in November, December is about. It's called Making Photographs, Developing a Personal Visual Workflow.
Hmm.
And it basically just spells out what I've just said. It's just like, if you can come up with a system of seeing and photographing that you can repeat, that you can fall back on, it creates a situation where you increase the chance of you not only being able to discover great scenes and great subjects, but being able to make whatever technical choices that you have to with respect to your aperture, your white balance, all of that stuff, in order to make a good photograph. And because I think too many people just go out and they just snap away and they're surprised why they're so inconsistent. And I don't shoot as many photographs when I go out as I used to, but I think my level of consistency has gone up. And every once in a while, I'm really able to knock it out of the park, but I think that's only as a result of being disciplined in terms of what my practice is when I go out and shoot.
So you're basically saying stop winging it, right?
Yeah.
Stop.
I mean, you can. I mean, you can just wing it, but I think most people are very dissatisfied with the great majority of the photographs that they make. They go out there, they spend all this money on this expensive equipment, they go out there, they make a great photograph, but you ask them, how did you do it? And they'll go, I have no idea.
Just luck of the draw. If you take enough of them, you're going to get one.
Mm-hmm.
Hmm. And when's this book coming out?
November, December.
November, December. Okay.
Yeah, I'm finishing it up right now. I'm going to be finished writing the text by the middle of the week, and then I have to get all the pictures converted over to CMYK and then ship that to the editor, and hopefully I'll have everything done on my end by the end of the week.
Wow. Well, I'm definitely going to watch for it. That sounds like just a ticket for me anyway.
Yeah, I think it's going to be a good follow-up to the first book, Chasing the Light. I think, you know, between the two of them, I think they'll really be a really good complement. Because my process has changed a little bit since then. I mean, it's pretty much a lot of the same principles in that book find their way into the new one, but it also reflects a sort of the evolution of my process since I first wrote that book.
So how do you go about getting published? I mean, did the publisher reach out to you and say, we want you to do another book, or do you come up with this idea and go pitch it to them?
Yeah, it's the latter. Mm-hmm. It's the latter. Basically, when I first did the book, I had an idea for the book, and I chose Peach Pit Press as my first go-to. They were the same publisher that had published all of Scott Kelby's books. Mm-hmm. And I saw the authors that they had published, and I felt like the quality of the books and everything was sort of in line with what I ideally wanted. Because there are about three, besides Peachbit, there are probably three or four other publishers of photographic books that were out there at the time. But Peachbit was like, that's who I want to publish the book. So what I did is I just went onto their website, and they have... they spell out exactly what you need to do in order to submit a proposal to them. So basically you're submitting what's called a query letter. And the query letter, you sort of explain what the idea for your book is, what it's going to entail, who the audience is, what books on the market are similar to it, and why is your book different. Mm-hmm. Then you submit a sample chapter that gives people sort of the feel for the content of the book, plus, you know, whatever images that you have to illustrate it, and you just send it out. And then you just wait to hear something back. And it was several months before I heard back. And we went sort of back and forth on the idea and the negotiating, and signed a contract, and then I got to work on writing the book. And then after that, after I finished that book, I was approached about writing a book with Vincent Laferay, who is used to be a New York Times photojournalist. He's now a filmmaker. And I basically ghost wrote his biography of his time at the New York Times.
Oh.
And so that was a fun gig. I enjoyed that. And then I did some other books for Peachbit on the 5D Mark II, maybe Mark III. I think it was the Mark II. Yeah, it was the Mark II. It's Mark III. I forget now. And I did a couple of other books, basically. They said, hey, do you want to write this book for us? And I said, yes. But I don't want to write those kind of books anymore. I kind of want to write books that I want to write now. And then that's why I haven't written anything in about 3 years. Because I said, the next time I write a book, it's going to be one of my own, and it's going to be a book I really want to write. And that's what making pictures is all about for me.
And you say you're not organized. I don't know about that. I mean, just being able to do all these different things and do them well.
Well, it helps that I have a supportive wife who, you know, for the large part, she's the big income earner here. So if I had to, you know, bring in a more substantial income, it would be really difficult because I would have very little time to be able to dedicate to these things as I do. So, you know, that is an invaluable help in terms of me being able to do all the things that I do and work from home.
She cracks the whip, huh? I've got one of those. Anyway, we're getting towards the end of our time here. I notice you've been going to a lot of festivals. Mm-hmm. You said you're just in San Francisco. I remember last year you were in Miami, by the way. I think I'm going to be down in Miami this year.
Oh, and, I'm hoping to get down there again. We haven't worked out the details, but I'm really hoping I get down there again.
So are these worth attending?
Oh, yeah. The Miami Street Photography Festival and the one that I just attended in San Francisco are really great. I mean, they had some really talented, amazing photographers present. Both. I mean, the one that I just went to had Jeff Mermelstein teaching like a 5-day workshop as well as doing a presentation.
Oh.
And Jeff is one of my favorite street photographers. He's up there with Joel Meyerowitz. And just fantastic. And I got a chance to sit down and talk with him. And hopefully we'll have him on the show soon. And then when I was in Miami, there's Constantine Manos, Maggie Stieber. I mean, these are people that are just... For people who know photographers, I mean, these are really big names. And the festivals are small enough that you can approach these people and talk to them. And, you know, if you can't swing it, you know, take a workshop with them. It's really just phenomenal. I mean, both are almost a week-long events, I think 5 days in both cases. And just the value. I mean, because both most of the public events are free. Which is great. So if you can just get your butt there, you know, buy a plane ticket, find a place to stay, you'll get to be immersed in street photography in a way that is unlike anything else that's available. Because when you go to the big photo events, it's not much is dedicated to street photography. It's portrait photography, wedding photography, or like Photo East. It's all about the equipment and the gear. If you really have a passion for street photography, I think it's really worth it to make that part of your schedule for the year.
Yeah, I think we've published a special edition last couple of years for the Miami winters. I don't know, yeah, Juan down there has just done an amazing job building that festival up.
Yeah, I commend Juan and the whole team there. And that exhibit last year was one of the most consistent exhibits of street photography that I've seen. I was really amazed because sometimes it can be sort of hit and miss. You know, you get some great work and you get some average work, but the quality of the work that they selected for that exhibit down there was nothing short of amazing. And the cool thing is that they had people from all over the world. It wasn't just this Eurocentric, you know, street photography, not just Americans and Europeans. I mean, they had people from Southeast Asia, from South America, from Central America, just people who are just really embracing this street photography, you know, sensibility and producing some fantastic work. It was really, really cool to see them acknowledged and recognized along with some other wonderful photographers.
Since I'll be living on the East Coast by then, it won't be too far away.
Yeah, it'd be well worth it to go down there.
Of course, I'm going to be in Miami just a few weeks before that because we're going to Cuba.
But
I'm going to come back home, but I'll make my way back there somehow. But I've been splitting my time between two different careers, and it's real hard to just get away and be totally immersed in one part of it. And this year I'm going to actually do it. So I really like the you had the panel discussion with the group of New York photographers on the Candid Frame down in Miami. So I recommend anybody to go back and listen to that. I thought it was a great discussion.
Yeah. It's one of the reasons I went down there was to do those panels, which is really interesting. You know, because most of my interviews are one-on-one, and this time we had like three or four people on the panels. So it's a little kind of like wrangling cats.
Yes.
You know, it's in terms of giving enough people enough sort of time, each person time to speak. And it's not my favorite type of interview to do because it's just a little more logistics involved in sort of managing the whole conversation. But you know, I think it has its place and it can be fun, but you know, I much prefer the one-on-ones as much as possible.
I think we've gone a little longer than I expected, but like I told you, I can talk about this stuff all day. So why don't you tell us, so what's next for you besides the book?
Besides the book, I'm got some workshops that are coming up. There's one I'm doing through the Los Angeles Center of Photography in New Orleans in October. I'm hoping to get enough people signed up for that so I can revisit New Orleans. So I'm going to be doing, I think, a 3 or 4 day workshop down there in a town that I really fell in love with the first time I went down there. And it is one of the greatest cities in the U.S. for street photography. I mean, just there's so much. The people, the food, the ambiance, whether it's shooting street during the day or early mornings or at night. It's just a wealth of stuff to be had there. And then I'm going to be doing one in October in New York City. And while I'm in Paris for vacation, I'm putting feelers out for anyone who wants to study with me while I'm in Paris for 2 days, because there have been some people in Europe saying, when are you going to come out here? So I put it on the calendar and going, well, here I'm here. And if no one shows up, that's fine too, because I'm there primarily for a vacation. But if people want to join me, I'm more than willing to work something out. So those are the things that are on the top of my priority list right now.
Well, where can people learn more about you?
They can go to candidframe.com, which is the blog for the show as well. They'll see links there for my photography work. And if people want to listen to the show, one of the easiest ways to do it is to just download the Candid Frame app, which is available for free both on Android and on the Apple iOS. And that allows you complete access to the entire archive of interviews. So you can download them, you can stream them, you can save your favorites. You'll get extensive show notes, so you can click on the hyperlinks, and it'll take you on your website to the website of the photographer on your phone or tablet. And it's just kind of the best way to sort of dig deep into the show.
Yeah, it'll make it easy to binge on the show on your next long drive. All right, well, thanks a lot. I tell you, I appreciate you taking the time, and it was a real pleasure to finally meet you. I've been meaning to do this for a long time, and I finally did it. Glad I did.
My pleasure, Bob. Thank you so much for having me.